Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What do you give a millennial for Hanukkah or Christmas or any other occasion when they don't seem to want any stuff? The generation of Americans born between the early 80s and the early 2000s is well into young adulthood, but they're arriving there without many of the trappings of success that their parents coveted. Coming of age in the midst of an economic downturn may be part of it, but my guest today insists that many millennials are more than happy not to own homes, cars, even music collections, as long as they can access these things when they need or want them. Much more desirable is renting or sharing possessions and using the money they save to pay for experiences. Leslie Bradshaw is managing partner of the digital design firm Made by Many and a researcher for the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. You can read her recent article, Rent Stream Experience, online at Medium.com. Leslie, welcome to Think.
Chris, thank you so much. I'm glad to be here.
Today's young adults are no less ambitious than previous generations, but it's been your observation that they define that success in different ways. Can you explain that for us?
Well, I think it's a really interesting thing to start with the economics and the professional side of things. To quote Patty Sellers of Fortune magazine, she says, you know, your career is much more of a jungle gym than it is a ladder. And I think that's a good starting point to think about how millennials are approaching not just their professional lives, but also lives outside of work. And with that, you think, well, do I want to just stay one place, climb up the ladder, maybe remodel, add a yard, or do I want to swing from bar to bar? Do I want to be the Tarzan or the Jane of the jungle? And I think that's what you're seeing both professionally, which we can dig into, but also from an ownership and renting standpoint.
So people really are valuing, younger professionals are valuing mobility and the freedom to sort of pack up and move or change directions when it seems right.
Definitely. And it's interesting to look at the factors, right? You know, you think about where we were in my grandmother's generation. She was born in 1921. She came of age, you know, kind of in the Great Depression, very fastidious, and also had the American dream kind of put forth to her in the 50s and 60s. We're coming of age at a moment when globalization and the ability to move about the country and the world is easier than ever before. And I think that's one important thing. And people are learning about other cultures and seeing what's possible beyond just their hometowns, beyond just kind of the ladder type life and workplace.
Millennials seem to be really interested in travel, but they're not necessarily doing it in cars that they own.
That's a really interesting point. When you think about where renting cars started from, it was really the car dealerships wanting to get people in the car to experience it. So they partnered and kind of rolled out things like Hertz and then Avis later. And you think about where that got disrupted, right? It went from just renting a car to micro and nano rentals, right? You think about down to the minute, down to the hour, down to the week, because people don't want things sitting on their credit card on their front lawn, or excuse me, the driveway, when they don't need it. And I think that's a really interesting concept about efficiency in the market. It's also an interesting concept, again, driven by technology. And it's something that underpins not just the technology industry in and of itself as it relates to computers and the internet, but it's technology empowering and disrupting so many of these places that enable these changes to happen. Again, it wouldn't have happened 50, 100 years ago because the technology just wasn't there. So there's a lot of factors kind of coming to play, but I would argue that technology underpins all of it and enables all of it.
So in other words, you don't have to, you know, make a phone call and try to figure out that next Tuesday at 1:15 you're going to need a car for an hour and a half. You can get on a digital device and figure all this out and where to pick up the vehicle, and therefore it's facilitated by technology.
Exactly. You have things, you know, on kind of one spectrum end, you've got things like Zipcar and even some of the major rentals getting into kind of the more micro and nano rental, to throw out a term that I think I just maybe made up. And then when you think about Uber and Lyft and other car services that are available kind of on the drop of the hat, when I was writing my Medium piece, you know, back growing up on a farm, I was envisioning success equaled maybe having my own driver someday. And I saw it on a movie and thought that's what I wanted. And come to find out that here I am, nowhere near being able to afford my own driver, but you get that same experience and the efficiency of the market bringing together drivers that are available, the supply to the demand of the person needing to go somewhere, and then facilitating once again through the application, watching it be tracked, and then being able to have your credit card right there without having to deal with some of the challenges that I've faced, certainly with cabs. It's, oh, my machine's broken, you can only give me cash, and you know, other such unpleasant things.
So my husband and I have four kids. Two of them are approaching driving age, and we've been astonished that they are not as eager, and their peers are not as eager to take driver's ed, to get their licenses, as we were at the same age not that long ago. And part of it is because they stay connected in ways that have nothing to do with being in the same room as their friends.
Mm, that's a really interesting point, and it reminds me a little bit of The Atlantic has been doing some particularly interesting pieces around this. Starting in 2012, they had kind of this piece around cars and millennials, and how the thought was, oh, you know, we're going to roll out these smaller, cooler kind of European cars. We're going to have the Ford Fiesta. We're going to have the Fiat 500, and millennials are going to love this. And turns out that they didn't do particularly well, not because they weren't an interesting offering, but it's because the buying pattern and the interest level has completely shifted. I think you're right to say that the reason for some of that shift is about accessibility through other touch points with someone, and also thinking maybe all my friends aren't actually something I could drive to. And so I'm leaning on things like WhatsApp or Facebook or other kind of social mediums, Skype, Google Hangouts, to connect with people.
And younger adults now are in larger numbers deliberately choosing to live in neighborhoods that won't require them to drive. Whether or not they have a car, they won't have to drive every time they need to run an errand.
I would love to see the data across the country. I mean, I'm certainly in a bit of a bubble here in New York City, where I live, work out within a few blocks, go to the grocery store, and it's all very contained because of the density of the population. But looking out into places like Texas, you know, where we're broadcasting from, I'd be really curious to understand what the ratio kind of population density to accessibility to all the things you need in one area. I will point out that my 93-year-old grandmother moved into our small town of Junction City, Oregon, because she wanted to be closer to everything, from the bank to the library to her grocery store to where she gets her hair done. And she's able to walk to all of those. And so she's even pragmatically thinking about the efficiency and not having to have a car and be burdened with getting around, parking, getting out of the car, and just be able to do it with your feet.
All right, let's talk about the sharing economy, because it's not just cars that people don't necessarily want to own. With a little bit of effort, you can even get around owning very many clothes.
Yes, there's a lot of really fascinating things unfolding, pun intended, with clothing. And I've looked, again, I look at my own behavior, and then I kind of look out to the rest of the world and see if I'm biased or if I'm, you know, particularly different. And not so. You have things like bib and tuck. You're able to bib things that you don't want anymore, and then you tuck things that you want from the site. So you have kind of this sharing economy points that aren't necessarily translating to dollars, but certainly allows you to just rotate through your clothing. And I think it's a fantastic idea when you think about the seasons. They change both in terms of temperature, fashion, the size of your body fluctuates, and the idea of kind of burdening or wedding yourself to a particular wardrobe or piece that isn't, as my mom would say, a classic, like a good black blazer, nice pair of jeans, like those things will last forever. But what you really need to think about is, what about all the kind of ephemeral things that come in and out of, again, fashion and our own tastes? And I love the idea of bibbing and tucking. I love the idea of Rent the Runway for special occasions. I can't tell you how many times I wish that would have been around when I was going to prom or maybe be a bridesmaid, and really be able to get the dress that you're only really going to wear once, only for a rental, and not have to worry about everything else. I'm just excited when they finally roll that out for different seasons and allow you to rent an entire wardrobe.
Yeah, and it's funny, even for those special occasions, even if you're sure you'll wear it again, you never do.
Right, and I start looking, as a kind of econ nerd, I look at the cost per wear, mm-hmm. and I get real with myself. I say, okay, you know, is this worth, if you're going to wear it once, is it worth $250 or $400 for that single wear? Is it valuable enough? Will there photos be taken? Is it a must-have piece? Or would you rather go on and spend $35, not own something forever, and be able to ship it back when you're done?
We'll talk in a minute about the sort of difficult economic conditions that faced a lot of millennials just at the time that they began looking for their first real jobs. But You know, I want to be clear that for some people, not owning a lot of stuff is a factor of poverty and it's not a choice. But I want to know, for you, do you find that the less you own, the easier it is to stop craving things?
Interestingly enough, there was a New York Times piece, or it was an op-ed by Anna North on the 15th of December, and she talked about how minimalism is in, and it's in vogue, and for people who could own things, they're choosing not to because that is in vogue. And I think that that's an interesting style and shift, going from that extreme materialism of the McMansion or the Hummer or these kind of large SUV, you know, taking up physical space as well as financial space, and to swing the pendulum the other direction. And what I've seen, you know, just personally choosing to do the career as Jungle Gym, you know, I've moved around throughout the country, from Chicago to DC to Miami to Los Angeles and now in New York City. And every time I move, I try to pare it down a couple more boxes, because I just realize how difficult it is to schlep it around. And then I don't even use it. And that's really aggravating. So I've given away quite a bit to charity. In some cases, I'm selling some of my pieces on consignment if they're a little bit nicer. And it does feel very liberating, not just from the sense of moving around a lot, but just from an ownership perspective. And it becomes just less interesting to me. But that's, again, that's me now in this moment in my life as a millennial. And who knows, 5-10 years from now, as I start a family, those things may all change. So I want to be careful to both examine my age as well as, you know, a certain kind of privilege, as you mentioned, with I get to choose whether or not I own things. It's not a necessity or a matter of my situation.
Well, you did actually anticipate my next question, because I do think, you know, it's pretty easy to live footloose and fancy free without kids or before kids. And whether some of it is dictated by our consumer society or not, children come with a lot of equipment and things that you have to have.
Certainly. And that's something I witness with some of my close friends who have children. And it's things that I've thought about. How might I raise my children to be more minimalistic? You know, having grown up in the kind of Northern California and on a farm in Oregon, we had a bit of a minimalistic approach to life. We didn't have a lot of TV channels, so we really didn't have a TV or have access to that. And there were certain things that were just a part of our lifestyle. And I wonder, is that too idealistic to think I might be able to replicate such a scenario when all the other children at school, they all have iPads or they have access to all these digital things? So it'll be really interesting when push comes to shove and I actually have to make some of these decisions with a child crying at a brunch with friends, and I just hand them the phone just to make sure that they're quiet. So we'll see.
Millennials who don't necessarily want to own a car or their own home, they're spending on technology for sure, mobile technology in particular.
I think I would have to look at some kind of broader spending shifts or patterns. Certainly technology, I think travel you brought up is an interesting thing, and experiences as it relates to even where they live. I have a good friend of mine here in New York City who rented out her home for the month of, I think, January, and she decided I'm going to live in Vermont and co-work and virtually work from there with my husband. And I think experience and home can also tie together. Again, one of the tenets of success in the American dream might even be owning not just one, but two homes, and the upkeep for that and the overhead. And might you maybe make it out 1 or 2 weeks of the year? Maybe you do a timeshare, but more pragmatically, use Airbnb, not only to rent your own place out, but then to experience someone else's.
We're speaking this hour with Leslie Bradshaw, managing partner of the digital design firm Made by Many and a researcher for the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. Her recent article, Rent Stream Experience, is available online at medium.com. We'd love to hear from you, whether you are living a minimalist lifestyle, if you're a millennial, or perhaps someone a little older. Our number is 1-800-933-5372. You can also email think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Graduate Liberal Studies programs. Accepting applications for January to design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree at SMU with concentrations in Global Studies, Creative Writing, and Organizational Dynamics. More at smu.edu/mls.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with Leslie Bradshaw of Made by Many. She's also a researcher for the U.S. Chamber of Commerce and author of the article Rent Stream Experience about the consumer habits of millennials. It's online now at medium.com. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372 or send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think. So, Leslie, I think a lot of people are aware that people are not necessarily buying a lot of physical CDs anymore. But it turns out a lot of millennials aren't even buying MP3s to have as part of their owned collection. They would prefer to stream this music and access it but not own it.
It's a really interesting shift when you think about, we were talking earlier about, first it was about owning a car, then the rental cars came out, and then now this kind of micro or nano rental experience. So when it comes to music, the same thing. It's being broken down to its most elemental parts. And you think, oh, the MP3 is the death of the record, right? And there was all of that worry. And then, you know, music holders and IP holders and musicians found ways to kind of monetize within iTunes, seemed everything was okay. And then here comes this second wave. You see people like Taylor Swift withdrawing her music collection from Spotify. So it's interesting to see where the monetization can happen for those who own the intellectual property, and yet at the same time, where these disruptors leveraging technology, not just in terms of the interface of the stream experience, but just the fact that they can stream at that quality level would have not been available or even possible a few years ago, not to mention 10 years ago.
So if millennials are willing to shell out money for experiences, what makes spending for, say, a concert ticket more satisfying than buying like $75 worth of MP3s?
Well, it's interesting to kind of look at this through the lens of the research cited in the Atlantic. Oh, gosh, it must have been in October of this year. A group of kind of Columbia professors and a grad student were looking at people's happiness levels prior to, during, and after a purchase versus an experience. And the anticipation of the experience elevated that happiness before. And then afterwards, they had a story. And it was funny to say, even if it was a bad experience, if it rained, if the band was bad, you have some sort of great story that you can kind of tell as a kind of passed down from generation to generation. Whereas with the stuff, they kind of mapped it out. People's anticipation beforehand was sometimes a little stressful around the holidays. You got to stand in line. Oh, you've got to worry about, you know, filling up your basket and paying for things, and you're not sure if you want to buy it yet. And there's all this kind of anxiety sometimes around the purchase. And even if it is a purchase you're excited about, once you get it, there's just diminishing returns of that piece of ownership, and it may start taking up room. You may no longer like it. It may evoke something of another time you wish to forget. And, here I might throw out, you know, just the economic concepts of appreciation versus depreciation. And you think about the appreciating assets that one can own, typically as a home, can be, you know, investments in the stock market. But I also like to think of, you know, you're investing in oneself and one's soul, not to get too philosophical, when you're experiencing things. You're investing in your own happiness, or maybe you're investing in education that itself can be leverage time and time again as you continue to cultivate your mind as well as advance as a professional. Whereas depreciating things is just about everything else. A car, you drive it off the lot and it's already dropped 10, 20, I don't know, 40% worth the value when you first bought it. So people, I think, are also being careful about the things that do have resale value versus things that can be used again in a smart and appreciative way.
Let's go to the phones now at 1-800-933-5372. We have Raymond on the line in Dallas. Hey, Raymond. Raymond, will you turn off your radio, please? Okay, Raymond is not with us. Let's move on and speak with Kathy in Dallas. Hey, Kathy.
Hi.
Hi, go right ahead, please.
Well, I just wanted to say that that I'm a consumer, that I don't think that everything is black and white. It's kind of a hopeful feeling, I think, is what I'm sharing. My daughter was brought up very minimalistically, and we've always focused greatly on, you know, for instance, she always played with sticks and built forts, and of course, we played with her. I think that's important. So we modeled that value system. And we did that until, the way I look at it, is kind of kids or kind of like sponges and don't have like a great filter, and they take a lot of what we teach them when they're really young as truth.
Yeah.
So until they get older and can really start to make their own decisions and everything, we did things very differently. And so now, even though we are consumers and we enjoy consumption, our value system is, I feel very good about it. You know, I don't feel anything bad about it at all. And our favorite thing in the world is nature. And I wanted to point out too that she did go to a Montessori school.
Well, that, you know, is kind of an interesting, thank you so much for your call, Kathy, kind of an interesting way to view the world. And it is, you know, what Kathy is pointing out here, Leslie, sort of points to maybe a difference in the generations. Do you find in your experience, are, say, Gen Xers and baby boomers taking any cues from the millennials?
Well, again, I think we need to just look at the trends that are underpinning all of this. Certainly, millennials have grown up, as you said at the onset, during kind of a moment of the financial crisis while also being digitally native. So these are kind of things that might influence their buying behaviors. But then let's think about Gen X and boomers. They're also living through the crisis. They may have lost some jobs during that time. They may have lost money, or their homes had foreclosures. So they're not exactly, you know, thinking everything is golden age 1950s, 2.5 kids and a picket fence. Rather, they're influenced by the same factors. And that's something my initial piece really focused on millennials. But as I started to kind of broaden my lens, I started looking at boomers, Gen X, and also even the greatest generation with my grandmother and her consumption patterns, which mirror a different moment in time, but have exactly the same outcomes as I think a lot of the things that we've been describing today, as far as not owning things and not being incredibly consumer driven or consumptive driven.
Yeah, I suppose there was a time in America where we were encouraged to define ourselves according to the things we owned, right? The brands we wore or the cars we drove. And there does seem to be a real hunger for moving away from that.
I think there is. And interesting to kind of think also where that drive was coming from. It's, you know, kind of post-war, we're looking at reviving our economy, and we were encouraged as Americans to go out and buy things so that we could jumpstart the economy. You think about the ways that we look at our monetary policy and our tax policy, it does relate to, do we want to encourage consumer spending and kind of jumpstart the economy that way? And it's always been kind of one of the tools in the belt of the government to think about balancing out our economy and stabilizing things. So that's at play, right? Then all of a sudden you have, you know, if you lived through a crisis or not, and you lost something or you didn't. And then you have technology, which is impacting all of us, no matter what generation you came from. It's making things more efficient. It's creating an expectation from the consumer to have the Uber or the Airbnb level of exactitude, of precision, of ease of use. So when they go to a company or a brand that doesn't have the same sort of interface or the same sort of modality, it's frustrating. It's not just frustrating for millennials, but you know, I see my mother, who's a boomer, she's plugged in and she's just right there streaming her Hulu and canceling her television with the best of them.
We have a tweet here from Mondo Tech Noir, who says, I've lived in 5 cities in 3 countries. My motto is digitize, simplify, and live.
I like that.
Yeah. 1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak now with Tim in Dallas. Hey, Tim.
Hi. Thanks for taking the call. I just want to kind of piggyback on that. I'm talking about the generational difference in attitudes and ultimately what effect it might have long term when the millennials are the ones on the plan commissions and places making decisions about what's allowable, where my son is a student at UT in Austin, and after looking for apartments and things and outrageous rents, he decided to go for an Airstream. So now he lives in a 16-foot Airstream in this guy's backyard. He pays him $200 a month, and he goes and showers at the gym. And something that when I went to school there, I would never have even remotely considered. But not only is he really, really happy with it, all his friends now are like, whoa, that's what I want to do, because he's living so cheaply, and he thinks it's cool, and they do too. And the question I'd have is, is this maybe something going forward that's going to change? Because, like, right now, you know, trailers, when it comes to zoning, it's the most undesirable zoning category imaginable, is like a trailer park. But that's an attitude that, you know, maybe came along out of when we were kids in the 50s and 60s for baby boomers. But now, with the economy being different, wondering to what degree, if they've found any evidence that maybe these kinds of attitudes are going to change and it's going to affect, you know, the way housing and housing policy decisions come about in the future.
That's a really interesting question, Tim. Thanks so much for your call. Do you have any thoughts on that, Leslie?
Well, I have a couple of thoughts. One, I think it's interesting just to look at the language Tim was using about what's cool, right? It's cool not to own stuff, whereas you might think 10, 15, 20 years ago, or if you watch, you know, the show Gossip Girl, you know, owning stuff is super cool. And if you don't have the right stuff or the right labels, then you're not cool, right? So I think that right there is always going to be a little fickle. And that's something to watch. The trends kind of come and go. Nobody can really predict it, unfortunately. I think it's really to do with the zeitgeist and a lot of moments. What you can look at as predictors, again, we're looking at what underpins all of this, is the, you know, vivacity of the economy. If there's ups and downs that cause uncertainty and have people would rather put the money under their mattress than in stocks, you can also look at the digital trends, and I think it will only increase as far as being able to crack open to the most fundamental parts, the ability to own a piece of something for a moment as opposed to forever. And as far as, you know, I think about even the most vogue of vogues, you know, Anna Wintour, she has a flip phone. And you think about, and I even considered it when my phone was stolen a few months ago, and I thought, well, maybe I just kind of simplify. You know, everything just seems overwhelming at times, and I'm always on, and I'm on apps, and I ended up not going with it because my job is requires much kind of digital usage and app testing. But I do think that there's something to that with the pendulum swinging in both directions. And to Tim's point, will it come back around? Will it be cool to own stuff again, or will this idea of whether it's, you know, keeping your footprint down, you know, thinking about the next generation, just thinking about our carbon footprint as a society and as a humanity at this moment, may really come into play the further along we get in our history.
It's worth noting that a lot of young professional millennials are also hitting adulthood with just a boatload of student loans to pay off, whereas their parents might have begun saving for a house or for a car. Millennials are still paying back for school.
That's another great factor. Again, I think we're looking at a lot of things, if we're just kind of putting all the variables on the table, that are pushing this trend forward. And some of it we can predict, some of it we can understand. Other parts, you know, all of a sudden it's cool to have an Airstream or a trailer, whereas I know certainly, you know, looking at wanting to be in the dorm, you know, wanting to be with everybody and be normal and be cool. And now the new normal is the exact opposite. But yes, back to the student loans. Absolutely. People are graduating with just a crushing amount of debt, and they have to be really savvy. Whenever you have a kind of a dearth of a particular resource, you have to use it wisely. And in this case, it's money. And, you know, being able to go further into debt, I don't think people want to take out a lot of credit cards and loans on top of the loans they already own. So I think that's a great point to underscore.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next on the phone to Suzanne in Carrollton. Hey, Suzanne.
Hi, good afternoon. Thank you so much for taking my call.
Sure.
I am a 50-year-old boomer who is turning to this lifestyle that your guest is talking about. I've downsized my home. All of our Christmas presents this year are going to be about the experience instead of just the stuff. And I have two teenage sons that I'm so excited I can sort of change their mindset from all the materialism in Dallas, which I grew up with, to this more freeing lifestyle. It's so much more fun. It's very liberating. You don't have to take care of all that stuff in your house. And this is just a fascinating topic. So I want to encourage all of my co-boomers to take the plunge. Thank you.
Thanks so much for your call. I suppose not surprising, Leslie, that her sons are down with this, that they are right in that squarely at the lower end of the millennial generation.
Yeah, what an interesting moment. Like, there just seems, as we're talking about all these factors, stars are aligning. And, you know, when I think about my grandmother downsizing, it was out of being very pragmatic, which she's always been. And she didn't want to be a burden, and she didn't like having to clean her big house. So she got an apartment. But I think when you kind of look ahead to kind of the McMansion or the some of the Dallas homes I've certainly driven by before, it's like that's a lot to take care of. And the older you get, do you want to take care of all of that? And if you don't have the means to hire someone to help you, you know, you just kind of ask yourself, you know, why would you want all that space? Because then you have to fill it up with more stuff, and then you have to dust it, and you have to clean it, and you have to replace it. And so I think it's a really interesting cycle that we're all kind of stepping back and saying, I don't know if I buy into this. I still want to have a good time. I still want to enjoy my life, but I don't know that it's owning things that will lead me to that happiness.
Are you struck by the things that even in downsizing your collection of possessions that you do hang on to? Like, are there particular items that take on greater significance because of all the things you got rid of, these are the things you keep?
I think it actually comes directly out of experiences and memories. You know, I have photos of my family are really important. Just the printed photos are so novel these days because we have such digitization and all of our social media, our Instagrams and Vine and Facebook storing all that in Flickr. I also think about things that were given to me by really special people in my life. I live with my younger sister, and you know, she and I were reflecting on this. She's lived all around the world in Dubai. She's done work in Afghanistan, South Africa, Ukraine, and she's gotten very good at living out of one to two suitcases and just really paring down and asking herself, do I need this? I think we've all been, I'll raise my hand, guilty of overpacking when you go on vacation or I'm going home to see my folks in Oregon. You don't want to be bringing everything you own. And I think even that I've kind of checked myself and said, you know, Leslie, you can really just get away with a pair of leggings, jeans, and mom can do laundry if you really need her, or borrow one of her sweaters. And I think there's just is it both practical kind of outcome of all of this? I think stepping back and then, you know, just realizing that there's so many other ways to kind of experience life. So yes, I think memories become more important. Special things from special people become more important.
We're speaking with Leslie Bradshaw, author of a new article on Medium.com called Rent Stream Experience. She does research for the U.S. Chamber of Commerce and is a managing partner in the design firm Made by Many. We'll come back to our conversation about the minimalism of millennials. I can get that out in just a couple of minutes. If you'd like to join us, the number is 1-800-933-5372, or you can email think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Graduate Liberal Studies programs. Accepting applications for January to design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree at SMU with concentrations in Global Studies, Creative Writing, and Organizational Dynamics. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with Leslie Bradshaw, who's a managing partner of Made by Many and a researcher for the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. You can find her article, Rent Stream Experience, online at medium.com. You can join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372. That's where we find John on the line in Dallas. Hello, John.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Sure.
I just wanted to make a quick comment and question. Let's say I'm on the upper end of the millennial generation, I guess, but I lived in Boston for several years before moving to Dallas, and I appreciate everything that we're talking about. I know there's a tremendous amount to gain by sort of reducing what we keep and own and have. My question is kind of the psychology of moving to what do we lose? Just in Boston, for example, like trying to go skiing or hiking, I was sort of disincentivized to rent a car and try to make it to New Hampshire. And you know, I think there might be some other things like that I haven't thought of and haven't experienced. But
you mean like if you could have just jumped in your own car, you would have gone, but having to go to the trouble of renting,
Right? And again, I think it's all psychological because otherwise, I probably would have had a car payment and insurance and all that, and I would have been spending more anyway to go once a month to go skiing as opposed to renting.
Well, definitely, Leslie, there are trade-offs with either approach, right?
Definitely, and I think that even pulling back from, you know, not having it right exactly when you want it, I think we're getting pretty close in certain cities around certain kind of micro-nano rental experiences, but they can also be cost prohibitive. You know, I wouldn't want to take an Uber from Boston out to a ski resort. That would just be silly. And I think that there, you know, might be a resurgence around train transportation or other modalities. I think there's even some shared ride opportunities or even options within some of these rental car services that are kind of interesting to see how those play out.
If it is, if it's like months or years between the times that you have to drive, is it strange to get back in the car behind the wheel?
I did not have a car going to school in Chicago, living in Washington, D.C. And then I briefly was in Los Angeles and Miami, and you cannot get around. You cannot survive without a car in those cities, unfortunately. I thought in Miami, oh, I'll bike everywhere. It's really hot. And you, by the time you get there, you're just dripping because it's, you know, so humid. So yeah. I think there's definitely regionality considerations. And I think we also need to be thinking about, you know, what the displacement does, not just for our own habits, but what it does for the economy, right? If we stop consuming, then maybe manufacturing dips, right? And we've already kind of seen a shift in the kind of labor force that we have here in the States, where we don't necessarily do a lot of manufacturing here. It's really overseas. But let's not fool ourselves, right? Those iPhones, they're made by employees of Foxconn. And you think about, you know, Samsung, they've got cities of people living, working, and rotating through. They're buying from the kind of corporate company campus, and then they're making stuff for us. And then, you know, it's just that's their existence and their living. So we are able to kind of, again, put that out of sight, out of mind. But I do want to call out that it displaces certainly certain segments of the economy when we choose and kind of have this voting with our dollars into new economies around streaming versus owning, right? And there's people that lose out and there's people that win, you know, people, the disruptors that come through. And then there's also the thought around just playing old, you know, just jobs and what type of work people are trained for, you know, if there's just structural unemployment when trends and things shift and how that impacts here in America, but also abroad. And because we are so plugged into these other economies, it'll be very interesting if this continues, you know, what does China do? Because a big part of their economy is around manufacturing goods and things for the world.
I don't know whether you have data on this or if maybe you could just give us a sense of what you've observed from your peers. Do you find that if and when millennials get to a point where they do have some disposable income, are they spending it on experiences or are they putting money away? Are the millennials good savers when they can be?
This is an interesting area that I've actually seen a few companies and others crop up to specifically advise millennials on what to do with their money. And, you know, I've seen a couple of different examples. I've definitely seen from my hometown just some really smart uses of their money and putting it into homes because those are assets that can appreciate. And they've made a decision that that's, you know, where they'd like to be with their life. I've also seen some peers of mine, instead of going into the stock market or homes, they're looking at investments, angel investments, very small amounts, you know, a few thousand dollars in some cases, into startups and companies in which, you know, they have an opportunity to experience liquidity should the company sell or go public. So these are kind of interesting new areas in which money can be exercised for long-term wealth creation, because I think that's another danger that we're kind of thinking about. Okay, if we're not owning homes and we don't have a lot of assets that can be liquidated if we needed to for retirement or for other purposes, then where is that wealth creation coming from? And that I don't have data on it, but certainly very, very interested to dig a little bit deeper there.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Rachel is on the line now in Dallas. Hey, Rachel.
Hi. I had a quick question for you. My husband and I are both artists living in Dallas, and we love listening to like Seth Godin talk about living in a post-industrial society and consumers and producers both thinking about shifting from valuing quantity or shifting from quantity to quality products, and I feel like that relates to experiences. But I've also seen, aside from this like minimalist lifestyle, I feel like there's a rise in artisan culture, in people wanting to start their own small businesses. And I'm just wondering if your guest has any research or comments on that.
Thanks for your call.
I think there's a really interesting thing. Once again, you're going to hear me harp on this, but technology is lowering the barrier to entry and the transaction costs to start a new business. You know, I think about whether you know, just to market yourself, to be able to get, you know, whether it's like kind of the new customers or even just manage the infrastructure of your business. You know, our parent company is based in London, and we have a bigger office there, but we have about 12 employees here in New York City, and I do a lot of the operations work with our founding partner and CTO. And I'll tell you what, there's some great software out there for small businesses that do your payroll, like Zen Payroll, or all of your insurance needs, like Zenefits. And these are very affordable monthly subscriptions that we pay in order to create the sense of a back office. You know, you don't have to worry about, in some cases, employing multiple people to do these things. So again, software is displacing some of the people that have that skill set, but in turn, it's enabling small businesses to crop up, to start, and to run with much lower overhead costs. I also think about all the virtual employees and the distributed companies who don't even have office space. Think about that's one of the biggest things on the P&L is rent. And, you know, good friend of mine, Bill Butler, and his team, Butler Inc., they're distributed all over the country in Oregon, Ohio, Los Angeles, Washington, D.C., and that enables them to, you know, stay competitive, offer a neat price, and then hire employees in interesting areas who otherwise wouldn't all be in the same place.
That's really interesting, because I think there is a lot to be said for the ability to take more risks because the financial leverage is not quite so high to start a new business. And a lot of people love working remotely. There is something to be said for sort of showing up to a physical location. And many times, you know, newer employees in companies that do business this way don't get a choice. It's either you don't have a job or you accept kind of officing out of your dining room.
Certainly. And if you would have talked to me 5 years ago, I would have been very much on team virtual working, and I was loving it. And we were saving money when I had one of my first companies. But then I got lonely and I missed people. And we did a great job of chatting and Skyping, but there was definitely some strain on the amount of time zones you have to stretch across to deliver against something or to collaborate. It's very hard to have that. There's also, you know, just the camaraderie and the kind of spontaneous stuff that just happens in an office. And that was a big draw for me to join the Made by Many team, is because they were very adamant that everybody comes in every day so that we can, you know, build really complex systems together. And we're not really interested in having virtual employees or, you know, people that are freelancing or outside of the New York area. We want to all be together so that we can solve big problems.
Let's jump back on the phones here. We have Alex on the line now in Dallas. Hey, Alex.
Hi. Thank you for having me on the show.
Sure.
I just have a quick comment. I am a millennial. I am 23, so I graduated high school right around 2008 when everything started the downturn. And so I saw my parents go through very tough financial times, and so I kind of structured my life pretty much around experiences, and I chose my photography as a way to experience things. And I took a job after I graduated school on a cruise ship. I got to travel around the world with that. And then I took a job after that that allows me to travel all around the country, and I currently live in Dallas. And I also want to say that I work remote, like you guys were just talking about, and I do see, I love being able to work from home and work remote, but I do see your guest point about being lonely, because I do get lonely, and so I actually took a second job as a waiter. So I love the minimalist life, and I love being able to travel. And I value very much the experiences that it has given me.
Really interesting perspective. Thanks so much for your call, Alex. I'm wondering, Leslie, you know, hearing from people like Alex, obviously there are a lot of old school companies out there that still want to make money and want to employ people, and how you've seen them responding. I'm guessing that's why the Chamber of Commerce is interested in some of the work that you do and understanding the nature of the marketplace these days.
Right. The millennial workforce is, you know, a topic that I'm fascinated by because I'm in it, because I employ people that are millennials. And you know, it's, again, technology makes it possible for us to work remotely because we have the bandwidth, we have the signal strength, we have all of those things that allow us to collaborate from the cloud, to touch base with colleagues, to have FaceTime. We don't have to buy really sophisticated, you know, tens of twenties of thousands of dollars worth of cameras and TVs when you think about the teleconferencing industry as it first came on the scene over a decade ago. So yeah, so again, technology's there enabling and kind of making this more affordable and accessible. And companies are responding in interesting ways. I think the most extreme example of a large company kind of changing its tune would be when Marissa Mayer came into Yahoo. And she took a lot of flack for eliminating the kind of work from home policy that was, it seemed to be kind of rather liberal and reflective of perhaps, you know, some of the other large technology companies they compete with. But here's the deal. She had a big remit, which is you need to really turn things around here at Yahoo. You need to innovate. You need to do stuff that we haven't done before. And I'll tell you, working at a company who creates very sophisticated, really game-changing software products for our clients, we have to all come together on the complex problems in one place. It's just, there's no way around it. So I do empathize and understand why she made that move. And I think there's people, it comes in and out of waves. Sometimes you love working at home, but then there's no separation between work and home. And maybe you haven't showered yet and the dog's barking in the background and your husband comes home or your kids need something. And so I think people are all of a sudden, oh gosh, I can't wait to get back into the office. Or maybe I'll take a second job as a waiter just to feel some of that kind of social aspects that we crave as human beings. So it'll be interesting just to watch how it plays out. But I don't think that any one system is perfect. And I think there's different conditions under which it makes sense depending on the industry.
Do you do any kind of holiday gift giving? I'm wondering what that looks like for you.
Well, this year, it's going to be very much focused on experience. So just traveling home, being present with my parents, turning my phone into airplane mode is one of my new things I do.
That's a gift.
Just to really... Yeah, that's a gift. It's a respect of people's time. It ensures we're going to, you know, really be present with each other. The other thing I'm really into is things that people will use every day. So I look into my cabinets, I look into, you know, my wardrobe, and I've been noticing that I use a lot of coconut oil, whether I'm cooking, putting it on my teeth, my hair. I'm a little bit of a coconut oil fanatic, so I think maybe I'll just get everybody coconut oil because they can use it all the time. I even used it on a squeaky door the other day, and it worked. And I'm also thinking about things like, you know, a perfume or a lotion or something that, you know, people can... It's a utilitarian thing that smells a little nice, is a little something special, but it will get used. Because the last thing you want to do is give a gift that won't be used. And I think that's one thing that I'm really thinking a lot about this year.
Leslie Bradshaw is managing partner of the digital design firm Made by Many and a researcher for the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. You can read her recent article, Rent Stream Experience, about millennial minimalism online at Medium.com. Leslie, it's been a real pleasure to have this conversation. Thank you for making time for us.
Chris, this has been so fascinating, and I loved all the comments from your callers as well. Happy holidays.
You too. Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is assistant producer. Jeff Whittington is executive producer. You can find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think, and you can contact the show via email at think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.